I'm Anthony James Hall, Tony Hall, Professor Hall. I retired from the University of Lethbridge in 2018. I'm currently Professor Emeritus, and I went through quite a hard time at the university where the Zionist lobby wanted them to get rid of me. They tried to do so, but we ended up in court, and the Faculty Association, we won the case against the Israel lobby, which had taken over the board of governors of my university. So I opted to retire at that point, and because I was full professor, I retained the title of Professor Emeritus. So I'm kind of wear that banner somewhat proudly, because it was quite a thing to survive when you get an attack like that. But in any case,
Anthony. But what about your what was your field of study? What were you teaching?
Yeah, well, I did my PhD in history, and I specialized in Canadian history, especially Indian policy. And so I looked at the history of colonization of Indian people, of the lands of Canada, the fur traders or the missionaries or the soldiers, or then came, the railways and the privatization of land along with the railways. And I found it was a good basis to look at sort of global geopolitics, that so much of world history is shaped by this period of European expansion, where, there was a big population growth in Europe and they exported people. It wasn't just sending out battleships and missionaries and such. There were masses of people that came to North America, so that indigenous peoples became a small minority in some parts of the world. Then I started to look more generally at the, certain phenomena on a global basis. And I got interested in the story of 9/11. And it seemed like a good topic. I was sort of coming out of a period where I was doing Native American studies, and then I was doing globalization studies. And this 9/11 topic seemed to me like a good subject for globalization, many aspects to it. And of course, I was drawn to look at indigenous peoples in especially the Israel area in the Middle East, or Western Asia, as we now call it. And I started to notice there was a lot of evidence that Israel had a lot to do with it. And just generally speaking, my interest in indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere, it seemed perfectly appropriate to look at those same issues with respect to Palestinian people, say, in the area of Israel. And that's what brought me into sort of infamy with the Israel lobby that went after me. I've written books, of course. I think you have told me rather like Earth into Property, where I've taken the idea of the privatization of a whole hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, and sort of seen that as part of the history of capitalism. Marx touched upon it, but he didn't really go into it. That model of looking at how land is privatized, how, future stocks and all kinds of different type of intellectual property is privatized, how we've just divided the world into little segments and portions and divvied out the ownership of these portions. Corporations are sort of invented to do that. I've been very interested in everything to do with Israel, especially since, I was facing the level of recrimination that I did for trying to study the things that I was trying to study. And of course, I'm very drawn to this situation going on in Israel right now, Israel Hamas. Are we seeing a kind of preparation for what they refer to in with respect to Jews in World War II, the final solution? It seemed immediately, the way Netanyahu was talking, that the idea was this Hamas attack was going to be a justification for the kind of policies that this particular government in Israel has been emphasizing. They're done with kind of liberalism and live and let live approach to the indigenous peoples. It seems like they want to, you know, eliminate indigenous peoples, get them to leave, well, they're Arab people in this case, Palestinian people in the case of Israel. So I wrote about that. It seemed to me appropriate to talk about the escape of people from Gaza, which is like a prison city. So it seemed to me that it was kind of a prison break, a Gaza prison break that took place. And so there's a lot of evidence that this was, in the language of 9/11, you know, some say, was 9/11, was it allowed to happen? Was it let to happen on purpose? Or was it made to happen on purpose? And in this case, with respect to this current, in a way, a kind of extension of 9/11, because the Netanyahu was a key player in 9/11, it seems that there's government has somehow colluded with some aspect of Hamas or a faction within Hamas or some other scenario that I can't imagine. But it seems that this was let to happen, that the gates were left open, that 15 places in the partition wall holding in the Gaza inmates, you know, was severed. And the IDF didn't respond very quickly. And there's increasing number of questions about, you know, is the story that we were originally given, is it, are there aspects to it? For instance, this rave dance or whatever was going on in the desert. There's this story of somehow these hang gliders assembling and then coming in and attacking from hang gliders. Frankly, I find this idea that the Hamas has somehow been practicing hang gliding inside Gaza and comes out with a full-fledged approach to, you know, attacking people with hang gliders. This seems to me kind of over the top, a little bit too Hollywood-y. And you know, we have to be conscious and respectful of the fact that real people have been killed in terrible ways, and now it's happening on both sides. And there has been, you know, wanton, random killing take place. But when it comes to like going door to door and murdering people door to door, you know, can we know for sure that Mossad isn't part of it? That if the outcome is a certain type of war that Netanyahu has made clear he wants, with the ultimate prey being Iran, and now Iran being so tied in with Russia and China, you know, if they could create a really dramatic episode and get the world and certainly the Israelis themselves really revved up by actually creating an element of this event that has taken place, this prison break that has taken place, by making it seem like it is horrendous, but more horrendous is the whole thing with the rave. I mean, it seems sort of highly concocted to me, highly suspicious. And this idea of being attacked.
Hang on, I ought to stop you because you're making all these comparisons to 9/11. You're saying that Netanyahu was one of the key players in 9/11. You need to really stand that one up, because for most people, 9/11 was Bin Laden and something completely different going on.
You know, Netanyahu has made a big career out of becoming a specialist in terrorism. And he organized in 1979 a conference in Jerusalem on international terrorism. And when 9/11 happened, he very quickly said, well, it's a good thing. And it was a good thing for Israel. Well, the United States, people in the United States sort of identified with Israel, and this idea of fighting terrorism, Islamic jihadism, this became the basis for, you know, a number of invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they tried with Syria, and they succeeded in Libya and Somalia, and this wars for Israel that came out of 9/11. And then, you know, once you get down to looking at it, like Al-Qaeda, you know, that was an adjunct of the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus used in Afghanistan to overthrow the Soviet-backed puppet regime. So this use of terrorists as a vehicle to facilitate and create the public opinion to enable wars on Muslim majority countries, it's just really surprising to me to see the viciousness of the sort of public opinion, how people are revved up to just immediately respond to this deluge of propaganda that, oh, we're supposed to hate Muslims again. That's the name of the game. And we're maybe going to eliminate all the Palestinians. And lots of people with, you know, no historical memory say, oh, that's great. You know, these Islamic people they don't fit in. It was ugly watching the aftermath of 9/11, which seemed to me to be created and seemed to many to be created with the first objective of poisoning people's minds against Muslims, against Arabs, especially against Palestinians, who are Muslim. And of course, many Palestinians are Christian and we don't hear about them too much, although they're persecuted along with the others. So after 9/11, you just refer to a Palestinian in Israel and you just call them, as a matter of fact, just call them terrorists. And we're seeing that kind of language. Now, 9/11 was an event which was presented, a specious account of what happened on 9/11 was presented as if it was the actions of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and a group of Muslim fanatics sort of acting alone based in Afghanistan. It was an audacious, fraudulent story. And it turns out that the project for the new American century, which promoted a certain military agenda for the United States, which they said could only be accomplished with some kind of a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And then it happened. And then we're told, oh, this is somehow all done out of Afghanistan. And within 3 weeks, the U.S. military was invading Afghanistan and looking for bin Laden in the caves of the border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this was really absurd. So the 9/11, of course, creates an atmosphere, a panic, where you suspend the laws, you empower the executive branch of government to make arbitrary decisions. We say that we saw the same kind of process kick in with COVID, the idea that there's a killer germ out there, that there's a kind of plague taking over humanity, and we have to empower our governments through emergency measures to be able to overcome all our rights and liberties and protections. It seems that this Hamas-Israel conflict is being described, and all the alarmism, all the basically bigoted, like anti-Semitic propaganda that's in the mainstream media. Because when I say anti-Semitic, of course, Arabs are Semites, and a large part of the Jewish population in Israel are basically Europeans, and they're not Semites. So all of this building up the mentality of hating Arabs and hating Hamas and hating Palestinians, we could call this anti-Semitic propaganda. Let's start to use some decent language. Of course, the language has been so weaponized. I mean, you say the name terrorism, you use the word hate speech. We used to have Muslim terrorists. Now we have domestic terrorists in the United States. And who are domestic terrorists? Well, they're white supremacists. There's not really much discussion about the reality of Jewish supremacy within, say, the Biden administration, where all, so many of the top officials are Zionists, like Victoria Nuland, who created the government in Ukraine in 2014, which was kind of an alliance of Jewish plutocrats like Kolomoisky and Jews. Of course, Zelensky is a Jew. So it seems that Jews and Nazis actually do get along quite well in some contexts, like Ukraine. Certainly there was a transfer agreement where the Zionists of Germany and the National Socialists in Germany made a treaty, and many tens of thousands of Jewish families migrated to Palestine with the, you know, good graces of the German government that allowed them to keep their property. Yitzhak Shamir, prime minister of Israel between 1986 and 1992, I believe, he was all intent on cozying up to Hitler. He didn't want to work with the British in World War II. He wanted to work with Hitler and Mussolini. And he was a big figure in the Stern Gang. So a figure that was very associated with the Nazis in World War II and would have liked to have been much more close to the Nazis in World War II was able to become prime minister for two terms in Israel.
Well, look, you've been touching on the Ukraine, and we had a bizarre statement not long after the Russian invasion from President Zelensky. He said he wants Ukraine to become a big Israel. And I just found this a very strange thing to say, particularly, I mean, he's basically saying he wants it to become a kind of security state.
Well, actually, I've been hearing this for the last couple of years. There's a place called Khazaria. You might, you know, sometimes people refer to the Khazarian mafia. And Khazaria is a part of Eurasia where there was a decision by a leading tribal leader who had to choose between Christianity and Judaism and Islam, and chose Judaism. So many of the Ashkenazi Jews come from that area. They're ancestrally connected to, you know, Turks and Mongols in this Khazarian area. And they're, you know, quite
well,
Caucasian.
I think we need to say it's part of Kazakhstan. It's at the north end of the Caspian Sea. Where Khazaria was.
Yeah. So the idea that Israel is proving to be a hard place in which to live. I wonder how much Israel might be sort of contaminated now with the different types of military operations that take place and testing and whatnot at Dimona and other types of testing that might take place. That it seems there may be a movement to say, like, living here, it's not really working out for us too well. One way to look at what's been going on in Ukraine is the population has been dramatically reduced. So what about the Khazarian Jews, say, and I think Schneerson, Rabbi Schneerson was a proponent of this, you know, let's move back to Khazaria and inhabit that part of the world. So that may be a serious agenda. And you know, Ukraine is being depopulated. Somebody might want to live there. I think that's to be taken seriously, that this may be, a development in the horizon, maybe not too far in the horizon.
Well, you know, clearing some sort of Lebensraum. But look, let's get back to Palestine and Gaza particularly. There's been a few things that'd be nice if you could address. One is the news stories that the Egyptians are saying 10 days before this happened, they gave the Israelis what they thought was a clear warning, saying, look, Hamas is planning to attack you. And which the Israelis, it seems, have ignored. Well, either the Egyptians are lying, or else, I mean, because something went very wrong with the security, didn't it?
And that's all, was similar to 9/11, that United States was getting all kinds of signals that something big was going to happen, and then maybe they wanted it to happen. So I've been listening to Efrat Finnickson, an Israeli woman who was in the IDF, in the intelligence service. And she says it's kind of just inexplicable that this breakout, this prison breakout of Gazans was able to take place. It took place in at least 15 different parts of the wall that were severed. And she goes into detail. She worked in that area on those, you know, around those walls, and they're very closely monitored. And if a cat goes close to them, for instance, the alert goes off. So it's kind of unthinkable that they would just let the wall be severed. And then the check through points, you know, where say Palestinians are going to go to work in Israel proper, and they have to go through a checkpoint every day. Those checkpoints were left open. And then when people were getting out, there was no IDF response for 5 hours. She kept emphasizing 5 hours. And so she, in her opinion, it's very clear that the Israeli government was in on some kind of understanding that this breakout is wanted. Now we're seeing that it gives the justification for wars and, you know, probably new frontiers of developments culminating maybe in a war in Iran. And that is like 9/11. You make an event happen with the expectation it's going to prepare public opinion and create the atmosphere where you can do things that you couldn't do otherwise. So that's, I think, got to be really closely considered. Now, when you look at Netanyahu's speech, his war speech, I mean, he's talking about, he literally talks about the savages, the Hamas savages, and then he talks about, you know, the ascendance of civilization over savagery. I've written about him as if he's sort of a wannabe Rudyard Kipling, you know, writing about take up the white man's burden, where, you know, there was this Darwinian view of history as a struggle between savagery and civilization. And Kipling was encouraging the British Empire on behalf of the British Empire for the United States to take over Philippines and eject the Spanish Empire from the Philippines and become the government of the Philippines, which did happen. So he's saying, you know, the dignity of civilization, if you want to defend civilization from barbarism, fight with Israel against the savages. When Israel wins, you know, all countries who are against barbarism, they win. And, you know, I just cannot see Netanyahu, you know, the primary liar and beneficiary of 9/11. And he did make quite a career out of it. It seemed to me in Paris in 2015 in the Charlie Hebdo situation, he was more or less walking around Paris like the Napoleon of the global war on terror. And, you know, he thinks he's going to try the same thing again based on this manipulation of public opinion and terror, not to say that some real terror hasn't actually happened, but who, you know, what's the dynamics of it having happened? Well, I mean,
just to reiterate, Netanyahu was actually in London at the time of the 7/7 London bombings back in 2005 as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, he seems to always kind of be on the scene. Can we say something about his whole political situation? Because we've had tens of thousands of Jews out on the streets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem every Saturday since the beginning of the year. The banners they're waving are things like crime minister. You know, basically Netanyahu's been indicted for fraud, several cases of fraud. He's now trying to change the constitution so that the Supreme Court can't prosecute him. He's managed to stall these things for a while. And there are quite a few voices from within the country itself saying that this guy is absolutely the least appropriate person to be in charge right now.
Well, there's this heritage of Israel's a complex place, and there's different views of how it should evolve. Mayor Kahani in the 1980s kind of pioneered an approach that Israel should be very, Jewish supremacist. That Palestinians or Arabs have no place there, that they eventually should be expelled or eliminated one way or another. But certainly in the interim, there should be like no social interaction between the people. I mean, Kahani was so radical. He founded the Jewish Defense League, which was considered to be a terrorist organization in United States and Canada. His Kok party was deemed to be unacceptable in the Knesset, and he, although elected to the Knesset, could not sit in the Knesset because he was deemed by the governing body of the Knesset to be too extreme. So this opinion, this approach, which tends to be among, you know, Orthodox Jews who have a religious interpretation, it's prevalent, and it's developed through this figure called Ben-Gavir, especially, who seems to be really obsessed with building the Third Temple and getting rid of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the, you know, Hamas movement that broke out of prison, call themselves the Aqsa Flood. So this extreme government, and he doesn't want the judges to have any role in it. And of course, he's trying to keep out of prison himself. This resulted in these demonstrations, largely from more liberal Jews or Jews that go back to the origins of the spirit of the founding of Israel, which did have some, you know, labor and socialist and even communist dimensions to it, some secular dimensions to it. And that's all gone. And those people were demonstrating and will probably leave Israel. So Netanyahu has presided over a real weakening of Israel. Israel is divided within itself. Israel is not a secure, stable place by any stretch of the imagination. And probably a lot of Jews will want to emigrate from Israel and go somewhere else. So there he is. This war gives him a standing, and he's trying to present himself as this spokesperson and this embodiment of higher civilization against Arabic and Muslim savagery. And it's really an ugly spectacle. And, if anybody in history these days at the upper echelons, where there's a lot of terrorism and savagery taking place, and he kind of embodies that spirit, it's kind of gross to see him give this speech where he presents himself as an embodiment of higher civilization, and we should join the cause of the Israeli fight against Palestinians to advance the cause of civilization. No, we've seen that before. It's a subject, I'm well versed in, looking at the rationale for imperialism and colonization in the Western Hemisphere, for instance. And here it is well into the 21st century, and we're getting this throwback to sort of Kipling-esque references to, let's take up the white man's burden. Send forth the best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile, to serve their captive's need, to wait in heavy harness, unfluttered folks and wild. Your new caught sullen people, half devil and half child. Think of that, half devil and half child. I mean, that's the spirit of what he seems to be proposing as his destiny to lead this cause of higher civilization in eliminating Palestinian people, the indigenous peoples, from the land of Israel. Some kind of civilization that is. And by the way, this idea that Israel has a right of self-defense. Well, so do the Palestinians, and other people have the right of self-defense. And when I talk about the Palestinians, I can talk about the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. I can talk about the Palestinians who are locked up in Gaza. I can talk about the Palestinians who face, their olive farms being wrecked, and their houses being pushed down, and their water being stolen in the West Bank of the Jordan River. Or I can talk about the Palestinians in the refugee camps, or I can talk about Palestinians all over the world. And all of these Palestinians collectively also have a right of self-defense, which, is not dealt with in international law. If we're going to be civilized, we should have some place in our way of behavior that applies international law to, say, Israel and Palestine. Now, of course, when Israel was established in 1947, 1948, Resolution 181, there was to be two states. There was to be an Arab state and a Jewish state. So the Jewish state has been formed, and the Arab state was to be in the West Bank, which has been taken over. You know, the terms, and Jerusalem was to be an international city with the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all having their place of protection. Now this maniac, Ben-Gavir, he wants to push down the Al-Aqsa Mosque and build the third temple on that land. And the third temple, it seems to me, is a kind of metaphor for the new imperial center of the world. You know, the Sanhedrin, the wise sages will collect in Jerusalem, which will be the kind of base of the one world government. That's how I see it and understand it. And that doesn't seem to me like the way to go. Multipolarity, you know, more like the BRICS approach seems to me a much more moderate and intelligent way to go. And,
well, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that the BRICS approach is going to win out the way things are going. But let's have a look at it was actually the Times of Israel back in 2018. On Shlomo Allegra's blog there. He did a fantastic article, I thought, looking at the history, because we're not getting hardly any context. Yeah. This is one of the things I can remember. The BBC did a great job back in the time of about 1990 of the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
All the correspondents were well-versed in their history. They were absolutely at pains to point out much of the, you know, the sort of the Sykes-Picot, these kinds of things that have been going on. Previously, so the influence of the European powers on the way that the Middle East had been shaped, etc. So what Shlomo's done is he's pointed out, well, actually, Hamas was Israel's own creation. He begins his piece, during the early 1970s, the greatest enemy to Israel was known as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, was known for waging terror attacks on Israeli citizens and targets all over the world. It was known also for being a socialist organization whose purpose was the elimination of the state of Israel, along with the establishment of a socialistic state of Palestine. And the constitution would be run by a kind of secular Marxist rather than by Islam. And he goes on to explain that the Israeli state decided that actually it was quite important to try and steer the local population, the Palestinians, away from this. And of course, well, I don't know how many people remember this, but there was evidence that the Israelis killed, poisoned, assassinated the PLO leader. Just remind me of his name.
Yasser Arafat.
Yasser Arafat, using polonium. That Hamas is Israel's own creation, and that's according to the Times of Israel.
Yeah. Well, is his name Hart? There's a three-volume history of Zionism, and the author, who's a BBC journalist, and you wouldn't get this nowadays in the BBC, but he got to know Arafat quite well, and he writes about him based on a lot of discussions and knowledge of his, you know, more intimate personal side,
as well as his public side. You're talking about Alan Hart?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, who we've interviewed on our show before he died a few years ago. Yeah.
And, you know, so he writes about Arafat in like a deep way, a knowledgeable way, not a, you know, a PR advertising smear job like most people do these days in the mainstream media. And the understanding I got of Arafat was he was kind of the he was trying to talk down the hardliners. And he was trying to persuade, look, we're, you know, we may just get a tiny portion of our ancestral lands, but let's make some kind of deal. And if we go around and, you know, do violent acts and such, we're not going to be able to negotiate. So he was within the Palestinian movement a voice for moderation and negotiation, although that's not how he's depicted. And there was a, you know, this was attracting a lot of attention, not only from Palestinian people, but people around the world. And it was kind of nationalist, secular, let's say materialist, which might be a code for, you know, communists. There were certainly communists in that movement. that this was creating, you know, quite a swirl of activism, of enthusiasm, you know, in the global community, including among Palestinians, but also among other people as well. So the old story of the Orientalists, the Bernard Lewis, you know, in conflict with Edward Said, these Orientalists, of course, want to haul out religion and make religion the organizing principle, and maybe less people will get involved, and there's more room to develop, you know, secular animosities. And so, yes, it's true that Israel had a big role in creating Hamas, and developing Hamas with like social clubs and sort of social service agencies, and making it something that many people in Gaza would look to as making their life better, and would identify with it and want to be part of it. So it seems that Hamas, and apparently Hamas still has his bank account at the same bank as you know, the Israeli government. Like, they get a lot of money from the Israeli government. So it's not just an ideological thing to start this. It, you know, Israel invested in it. So we don't hear discussions about that kind of subject. And to my way of thinking, when journalists avoid talking about that kind of basic history, you know, it's an incitement to, you know, very dire consequences. Like during COVID, when they're lying about the dangers of the jab, for instance, the outcome of those lies is that people die as a result. And when the dying and maiming and making people have a, you know, slow, terrible, agonizing death or die quickly, I mean, this kind of lying has life and death consequences. So the and let's face it, you know, most of the media has a strong Zionist bias. And so there's a lot of stories we don't get. And so to push us into war and make us sort of victims of this vicious propaganda, which is an encouragement to hate a certain kind of people, a kind of people that are like one third of the world population, Muslims, you know, this is a tragic, awful act. So I'm glad I went into a history PhD, you know, I find it very edifying. I find it very important to be able to talk about what's going on right now, but bring to it historical episodes, develop the genesis of things. How did they develop over time? And I've appreciated over the years, you know, we've talked many times to Bristol. How do you do, Bristol, Tony? And so I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things.
Yeah, I mean, you could even go further back and say that this was unfinished business back during the medieval Crusades. You know, this is the extent to which we're being told about these things in a tiny little bubble that doesn't take in this historical context at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a fascinating subject, and the, you know, and it's a subject that's very dangerous to talk about, and I found out the hard way because I, you know, did talk about it, and it seemed to me that it was perfectly legitimate in a university to talk about what happened on 9/11 as a academic specialty. And the more you looked at 9/11, the more inescapable it was that it had a lot to do with the Project for the New American Century, with Zionist organizations, with neoconservatives, and that it wasn't done by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. I've got a couple of articles in my new Substack called Looking at the World from Canada. If Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda didn't do 9/11, then who did?
And, well, you know, I mean, I can tell you, Israel did it. There's a very good article, 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world, which is on the WikiSpooks.
Yeah, website, that's a very in-depth yet, you know, succinct article in WikiSpooks.
It is, and I mean, you know, really the idea is, you know, that the Americans are doing a lot of work for Israel in the Middle East as a sort of proxy. You know, the various invasions have been balkanizing the Middle East. The Yinon plan, the Oded Yinon plan to balkanize the Middle East, ultimately to kick off a conflict, a kind of religious war. So we know what you're talking about, saying about Al-Aqsa. Maybe it's moving, you know, inching a little bit, closer with this. But look, can I just ask you where you think this is heading? Because there's a sense that the diplomatic, you know, telephone lines around the world, or whatever they have nowadays, probably internet lines, or maybe God knows, satellites. You know, don't know what they use nowadays, but a jangling as the Israeli government measures, maybe a little looks at its own people, thinks, what can we get away with here? And then also is trying to do deals around the world, saying, well, you know, we're threatening to do this, and the Gulf states may be pushing back. Where do you think this is going in the next couple of weeks?
Oh, well, a little sliver of information came my way that the G7 has written up a position, you know, supporting Israel and condemning Hamas. But Trudeau, of all people, of Canada, did not sign it. And why is that? Maybe he wasn't asked because he's become so sort of antisocial and he seems to be a bit stoned a lot of the time these days. Or maybe, you know, he actually has some kind of position. And I've heard reports that maybe the Democratic Party in the United States is not going to condemn Hamas. And, you know, the unions like the Public Service Union in Canada are going to make it clear that Hamas has its side of the story, too, and is not going to be more supportive of that. And then there is this, you know, it's like in after 9/11, there was this speed, you know, we've got to get on, move on. We all know Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did it. So let's invade Afghanistan right away. And within 2 weeks, there were boots on the ground in Afghanistan, no investigation whatsoever. And it seems that, you know, the mysteriously the Israel government was just geared up and ready to go almost immediately and go bombing and mowing the grass in Gaza, you know, within hours. So can we get an investigation? Can we somehow intervene in some way that and I am noticing that there are people talking this way, influential people talking this way, even within the Israeli government and the Israeli military. Something does not add up. And we need some explanations before we are pushed into, say, committing ourselves with war on Iran, which would be horrific, which would, you know, definitely be an entree into, you know, the final debacle of a nuclear holocaust. And of course, all of that, you know, we've been built up to a big war. It seemed that Ukraine wasn't to be what we were told it was going to be. So now just suddenly, as that thing that becomes deflated, they push us over into this new forum, Palestine, Israel. But it's obviously that's just the start. What about Hezbollah? You know, who is well equipped with missiles? You know, what is going to be world opinion? And even if Israel can get the governments with them, what about the people themselves who have kind of had are fed up with being lied to and, you know, pushed into physical health dangers and menaces and lethality and morbidity? You know, the money's system is breaking. The inflation is through the roof. So can governments just carry us along to say, oh yeah? But it's amazing how that propaganda is being, at least what I can see here in the ground in Alberta, you know, pretty effective in getting people to go back to hating Muslims.
Tony, whereabouts can people get hold of your books and follow you? You mentioned your Substack. And where, you know, what about these various interviews? What's the best way if people are interested in following your work?
So the Substack is called Looking Out at the World from Canada. And I've been doing a lot of publishing on Global Research CA. And if you were to Google Anthony Hall, author at Global Research CA, you'd find links to more than 100 articles many of it quite recent. I've been writing a lot about the COVID matters. And, you know, I do want to revisit the issues that came up, you know, near the end of my years in the saddle when, you know, suddenly the Israel lobby, I was public enemy number one, it seemed, in this part of the world. I learned a lot, you know, living through that. And so that subject of what's going on with Israel and the influence of the Israel lobby, you know, on the United States and the Canadian government and in Europe. This is a Europe, subject look, I like.
Listen, I have to interrupt you there because this coming week we've got the tribunal beginning of a certain Dr. David Miller. He's a sociologist at Bristol University.
I've met him
across his work when he was up at Strathclyde University.
Yeah.
He goes under the tag of Tracking Power, author of quite a few books actually on power, effectively on who's really running the show.
Yeah.
And so he's going through an employment tribunal after being sacked from Bristol University basically for pointing out the fact that the Israeli embassy was behind some of the groups which were trying to get him sacked and criticizing him and doing public posts and actually taking action against him for doing his job. And of course the University of Bristol simply caved to the Israel lobby and so let's hope that he manages to get some sort of justice in the
and
tribunal.
This lobby is doing horrific damage to universities by making, you know, killing free speech and saying, you know, well, we can't discuss something like we can't have revisionism when it comes to what happened to World War II and what they call the Holocaust. You just have to accept the whole thing as it is, or you're a denier, and then you can go to jail. You know, I have friends here.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, it's you cannot discuss who is funding the Jewish student group, for example, and you can't link back to where they're getting their funding from, and if you do, you're going to get the sack.
Yeah, so when I say the Israel lobby, you might think, well, that is far away and that doesn't really affect us, but it does affect something like the viability of universities and, you know, destroying the viability of universities by trying to shut down universities as places of open discussion and instead make them vehicles of indoctrination for powerful lobbies, especially that lobby. That's horrific. And so it's, you know, an issue that transcends Dr. Miller, myself, or the people who've fallen in front of that bulldozer. It needs to be talked about, and it's so hard to talk about it because it's dangerous to talk about it, and that's what makes it so important to talk about it.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you just running through your various websites because we're just keeping an eye on Dr. Miller's tribunal case this week.
Yeah, well, basically that's it. Of course, my two big books are The Bowl with One Spoon and Earth into Property is a title that you and I have discussed quite a bit. And the other volume is The American Empire in the Fourth World. It's a two-volume set. So that's the sort of major work of my, you know, that was a 15-year project. I'm pretty prolific. I write a lot of articles, and if you go to Global Research CA, you'll get a lead into articles.
Listen, I'm gonna bowl you a googly final question, which is who's in charge of this Anglo-Zionist empire?
Well, one of the things, you know, Netanyahu is clearly the veteran of it. You know, it's probably people whose names we don't know. You know, the Bank of International Settlements, I mean, it all comes down to the money, who's controlling the money. And, of course, the Federal Reserve Board in the United States, especially the New York Bank, you know, is important. So those high figures at the Bank of International Settlements, people who, you know, don't want to be upfront and very public. You know, ultimately, the story of following the money is a good way to approach
where does the power actually lie, and how does the power actually get expressed?
Okay, Tony Hall, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Tony.